The following preview is of a graphic audio production rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
Available now from Graphic Audio.
Mr. Fury, sir, I'm the Reverend Milsha.
Reverend, what can I do for you folks?
We are only 8 wagons and a small gather of livestock, but I am certain that we can attract a few more fellow pilgrims when it's known that we have procured the great Jedediah Fury as our wagon master.
Kansas City, Missouri. Great jumping off point for wagon trains headed into the Western Territories. Jedediah Fury, his son Jason, and daughter Jenny lead a group of pilgrims from all walks of life across the Great Plains to the Land of Promise, California. But common purpose doesn't always lead to harmony.
Let me alone, you big bully!
Hey, you, let him go.
Get lost!
Gosh.
What's your name, kid?
Milcher. Thomas Milcher.
I'm Jason Fury.
You all know me, my dear friends. And I say we should divest ourselves of the members of the Hebrew race. These crucifiers of Christ.
Folks, we've all throwed in together in order to make this difficult trip across the wilderness. And that means leaving our petty bigotries behind us. Everybody got that?
Circle the wagons in tight. Men, get your guns out!
Quick! Get those cattle and horses down here!
Dear God! Fury's down!
It's not.
I'm afraid so, son. Your father took a lance through the lungs. There was nothing I could do.
Jedediah Fury, wagon master and father, is gone. But Jason has no time to grieve. It's now his job to get the pilgrims to California, come hell or high water.
It's Carrie English! Her wagon's going in the creek!
God damn it, Fury! Do something!
Chrissy! Chrissy, you in there?
Is that you, Mr. Fury?
Chrissy, honey, come here. We're gonna take a little swim.
After many more trials and tribulations, the wagon train reaches Arizona Territory, where the weary pilgrims, notional as ever, decide not to go to California after all.
Tomorrow I shall consecrate this land, and we shall also name our new town.
I vote we name it for Jason's daddy.
You're going to name the town Jedediah?
No, boy. Fury. And we'll build it right here, right where we are standing.
Megan?
You're not going to stay, are you?
Not any longer than I have to. I'll stay long enough to help get the first buildings up and make sure you're settled in, but then I'm going. Do you understand, Megan?
You love me, Jason. And I love you, too.
But Megan...
Good night, Jason.
Oh, crud.
Hit the Trail West with a new series by William W. Johnstone with J.A. Johnstone. A Town Called Fury. In Graphic Audio.
And now, for our feature presentation.
Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents William W. Johnstone's Matt Jensen Number 1, The Last Mountain Man, narrated by Dylan Lynch, with performances by Thomas Penny, James Lewis, Michael Glenn, Andy Clements, Eric Messner, Casey Platt, Stephen Carpenter, Michael John Casey, Bobby Aselford, Lily Beacon, Joe Brack, Tim Carlin, David Cohen, Colleen Delaney, Johann Detweiler, Tim Getman, Christopher Graybill, Ken Jackson, James Konacek, Scott McCormick, Tony Nam, Greg Reinfeld, Richard Rowan, Nanette Savard, Mort Shelby, and Dylan Lynch. Matt Jensen, Number 1, last mountain man.
Martin Cavanaugh shifted his position on the saddle to try and find some relief from the bone-deep tired of 4 long years of war. Although Cavanaugh mustered out at Jefferson Barracks in St. Louis, he was still wearing the uniform of a captain of the Union Cavalry as he rode through Pettis County, Missouri, on this day in May 1865, on his long ride back home to Kansas. Just ahead stood an old, weathered, beaten building. For a moment, he thought it might be deserted. Then he saw a hand-lettered sign nailed to the side. Food, whiskey, tobacco, goods, beds. Cavanaugh didn't plan to waste any of his mustering out money on a bed, but he thought a meal might be good. Also, he could use a drink and a little tobacco for the trail. So he rode up to the building, dismounting at the hitching ramp. There were 2 men sitting on the porch. Both wore the tattered gray and butternut uniform of the Confederate Army. One had sergeant chevrons, but the tunic was so filthy they barely showed. He had a puffy scar starting above his left eye, disfiguring the eye, then streaking down his cheek and jaw like a purple flash of lightning, twisting the left side of his mouth into a sneer. The other man sported a bushy black beard, but the most distinctive thing about him was his left ear. Only half of it was there, the earlobe having been shot off in the war. Both men were thin. They had the look in their eyes and faces of men who had seen a lot of war. Warily, Martin nodded at them as he passed by them to go inside the building. The 2 rebel soldiers returned the nod, but they never took their eyes off him. One of them spat a stream of tobacco juice in the dirt, but neither of them spoke. The interior of the inn was a study of shadow and light. Some of the light came through the door and some through windows nearly opaque with dirt. Most of it, however, was in the form of gleaming dust motes that hung suspended in the still air, illuminated by the bars of sunbeams that stabbed through the cracks between the boards. Martin found a table in the back corner of the room near the stove. Since it was warm outside, the stove wasn't being used, but the smell of burnt wood clung to it like the low-lying early morning fog on a grassy meadow. The proprietor of the establishment came over to his table. Picking some sort of bug from his beard, he examined it for a moment, then flicked it away.
What can I get for you?
What do you have to eat?
Beans, bacon, biscuits.
All right, I'll have that. Do you have beer?
I got whiskey.
A glass of whiskey and some tobacco.
Chewing or smoking?
Smoking.
I got a woman here, if you'd like to spend a little time with her. It'll cost you 6 bits.
The proprietor nodded toward a woman who was sitting a few tables away. She smiled a toothless smile at him and brushed an errant tendril of hair back from her forehead.
No thanks. I've got a woman of my own and 2 kids waiting for me back home.
Yeah, suit yourself. I'll get your victuals.
He turned away from the table and walked back into what Martin assumed was a kitchen. As Martin gave his order to the proprietor, he saw the 2 Confederate soldiers come inside. They sat at a table near the door now, but he noticed both of them sat in such a way as to be facing him. Something about the way they were looking at him made him suspicious. So he eased his pistol out of his holster and held it under the table. The one with the sergeant stripes raised his chin.
Captain? You are a Yankee captain, ain't you?
The war's over, boys. I'm a civilian now, same as you 2.
Ain't quite the same. You still got your horse. The Yankees took our horses.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Name's Payson. Clyde Payson. This here's Garvey Laird. Now, it's like I was telling Garvey, we got us a long way to go, and the way things is now, about the onlyest way we got of getting there is by Shank's mare.
Well, Sergeant Payson, I feel for you, I truly do. I got a long way to go myself, and I'd hate to have to make the whole trip without a horse.
Yeah, well, here's the point. Me and Garvey here was thinking on maybe taking your horse.
What good would that do you? There are 2 of you, and there's only 1 horse.
We figured we could double up till we come up on another horse.
Oh, I don't think I would like that. And I know my horse wouldn't like it, being ridden double like that, I mean.
Garvey leaned back.
Well, now, that's real funny. Especially seeing as the horse ain't gonna have no say in the matter. And like you say, there's 2 of us and only 1 of you.
Payson and Garvey stood up from their table and walked across the room to Martin. Martin moved the pistol out from under the table and pointed it at them. The 2 soldiers, surprised to see that Martin was holding a gun on them, stopped in their tracks.
Ah, now hold on, mister. We didn't mean nothing like that. We was just gonna palaver a bit, that's all.
I'd feel a mite more comfortable if you boys weren't wearing guns while we were palavering. How about coming over here and dropping them down in the stove?
Now, why would we want to do a fool thing like that?
Because I'll kill you if you don't. I killed my share of men wearing that uniform. I wouldn't lose any sleep over killing two more.
The two Confederate soldiers stared at him for a long moment, but did nothing.
Use your thumb and finger to pull your guns out, then carry them over here and drop them in the stove.
The two did as Martin ordered.
Now what?
How long has it been since you two boys had anything to eat?
We had some hardtack yesterday.
Nothing since?
Both shook their heads.
Sit down over there.
Martin waved his pistol toward one of the tables. The two complied.
Innkeeper!
Yes, sir?
It wasn't until the proprietor replied that Martin noticed the man was standing just inside the door from the kitchen, holding a plate of beans, bacon, and biscuits. He had watched the entire drama unfold.
How about feeding these two boys? On me.
Captain, you do that for us after we was going to steal your horse?
Yeah, why not? And it isn't Captain. It's Mister now. Name's Kavanaugh. Like I said, the war's over. No need for us to be killing each other anymore.
Young Matt Kavanaugh knocked on the open door of the office of the R.D. Clayton Livery Stable in Fellsburg, Kansas.
Come on in, Matt.
Although only 9 years old, Matt was a big boy for his age and had proven to be a good worker for the owner of the livery.
I'm all finished, Mr. Clayton.
Every stall is mocked out.
Yes, sir. Every one.
Clayton was in his late 60s, a bald-headed, fat man with chin whiskers.
Don't think I'm not going to inspect the stalls. I'm paying you 50 cents a week to keep them clean. I didn't intend to throw away good money on a bad job.
You can check, Mr. Clayton. I cleaned them all.
You wait here till I get back.
Yes, sir.
Matt picked up the newspaper and began reading as he waited. Free land in the West. Reports have reached this city of much free land in the West. With the rebellion now put to rest, the government is anxious to see enterprise and citizens occupy land in the more western extremes of the nation, thus expanding the reach of civilization and enterprise.
Here, boy. If you want to read the paper, you will have to pay for it the same as I did.
I'm sorry, I meant no harm.
Clayton ran his hand through his hair.
Go ahead. Take it. I finished with it.
He stuck his hand in his pocket and pulled out a coin.
Here's your half dollar. You did good work.
Thank you.
Matt's mother, Mary, and his 14-year-old sister, Cassie, were hanging clothes on a line. They took in washing while Matt worked at the stables to make enough money to buy food. They were living in an old cabin that was within sight of a burned-out house and barn. The house and barn were part of what had once been a very fine ranch. It had been destroyed by bushwhackers 2 years earlier.
Here's my week's pay, Ma.
Matt handed the half dollar to his mother.
Oh, Matthew.
Mary put her arms around her young son and pulled him to her.
You are such a help. I'm so proud of you. You work so hard for the money that I just wish you could keep it for yourself.
Someone's coming up the road, Mama.
A soldier?
It looks like a soldier.
No doubt someone going home. We'll have to set an extra plate for supper.
Mama, why do we have to feed all the strays?
Child, your pa's on the road somewhere, coming home to us. Wouldn't you like for someone to be feeding him if he's hungry, or giving him a place to get out of the rain?
Yes, ma'am, I reckon you're right.
You go set the extra plate. I'll invite him. Maybe he knows something about...
Mary stopped and stared long and hard at the approaching rider.
It's him.
Mama?
Praise be to God. It's him! Children, it's your father! It's your father!
Spreading her arms wide, Mary ran toward the rider. The rider spurred his mount into a gallop and leaped down from his horse just as Mary reached him. They embraced in the middle of the road.
Is that Pa?
Of course it is. Don't you remember him?
Yeah, I remember him.
Though Matt said the words, he wasn't sure he remembered his father well enough to recognize him. Matt was 5 years old when Martin Kavanaugh left home as a lieutenant in the 9th Cavalry Regiment of Kansas. Matt's memory was hazy and consisted mostly of seeing a tall man in uniform riding away on the horse Buster.
No, I didn't bring Buster back. Buster was killed at a place called Pleasant Hill.
Poor Buster. He was such a good horse.
Yes, he was.
Martin got up from the table to pour himself another cup of coffee. Then he stood at the window for a long moment, looking toward the burned-out house and barn.
When did that happen?
3 years ago. Bushwhackers came by, burned us out, and took what livestock we had left.
I'm sorry. Here I go off to fight the war, thinking I'm protecting you, and the war comes here to you.
It doesn't matter.
Mary walked over to put her arms around him.
You're home now. Everything will be fine.
Mama, what about the bank?
The bank? What about the bank?
It's nothing. We can discuss it later.
Martin shook his head.
It won't go away by putting it off, will it?
No, I don't suppose it will.
What about the bank?
I'm sorry, Martin. I had no choice. I had to mortgage the place.
And now the bank wants to foreclose.
Mary wiped a tear away as she nodded.
I'm so sorry. I know how important this place was to you.
Nonsense. This is just a place. I've seen hundreds of places in the last 5 years. You and the children are all that's important to me now.
Mama took in laundry and I helped. And Matt works down at Clayton's Livery.
I muck out the stalls.
You've taken in your last laundry and you've mucked out your last stall.
But what are we gonna do? The bank wants the money and we don't have enough, do we? Did you bring any money home with you?
How much do we owe the bank?
$500.
Martin shook his head.
I don't have that much. But I have enough for us to start over somewhere else.
Start over where?
Out west?
Out west? Matthew, wherever did you get such an idea?
I read about it in the paper in Mr. Clayton's office. There's free land out west for people who want it.
Free land? I've never heard of such a thing.
Martin held up his hand.
Oh, I've heard that. I wasn't sure whether or not it was true, but I have heard it.
He looked over at Matt.
You say you read this in the paper?
Yes, sir. I read it today.
Free land in the west, huh?
Martin, what are you talking about? Surely you don't intend to just leave here, do you?
What is there here for us, Mary? My parents are dead, your parents are dead. Neither one of us has a brother or sister. What's keeping us here?
Well, nothing, I guess. But how are we going to get there?
You let me worry about that. First thing I'm going to do tomorrow is find out how a person gets hold of some of this free land. Then, if I see it's something we can do, I'll figure out a way to get us there.
All right. Whatever you decide is fine with me.
It's real good to see you back, Martin.
C.D. Folsom rose from his desk as Martin crossed the bank lobby. Folsom was president of the Fellsburg Bank.
Yes, sir. It's good to see all our men back home from that war.
Not everyone made it back.
Yeah. No, sir, they didn't. And that's a fact. How many did we lose?
3 officers, 192 enlisted men.
Folsom shook his head.
Well, now, that is a shame. That is truly a shame. But I'm sure you came to discuss business, right?
I did.
Your note is for $594.60. I'm sure you'll want to pay that off so you can get back to running your ranch.
594?
And 60 cents.
I thought the note was for $500.
Boy, it was originally, but with compound interest for 3 years, it comes to $594.60. You do have the money, don't you?
Martin shook his head.
No. No, I don't.
I see. Mr. Cavanaugh.
Martin couldn't help but notice that the friendly Martin had changed to the more businesslike Mr. Cavanaugh.
I hope you weren't counting on the bank extending your note any longer. We extended it once for your wife last year. Of course, I suppose if you could pay just the interest?
I don't have enough money to pay the interest either.
Then what exactly do you propose?
I would sell my ranch to the bank. You can give me the difference between what the ranch is worth and what I owe.
You have to be joking.
No, I'm very serious.
Mr. Cavanaugh, you owe almost $600. If the buildings had not been burned out during the war, it might be worth $1,000. But with the buildings gone, it's barely worth what you owe.
But it is worth what I owe.
Barely.
If I signed the ranch over to the bank, would it clear the books for me?
We are a bank, Mr. Cavanaugh, not a realtor.
And yet, when you loan money on property, don't you always run that risk?
We do.
Then I ask you again. If I sign the ranch over to you, will it clear the books?
I hate to see you do that.
I don't see as I have any choice. Nor you either, for that matter. Because I'm either going to walk away from here after making a deal with you, or I'm simply going to walk away. In either case, you are going to wind up owning the ranch. But in the latter case, you're going to be out the legal expenses of foreclosure.
I don't like being put over a barrel like this, Kavanaugh.
Now even the mister had been dropped.
Believe me, Mr. Folsom, I don't like this any more than you do. But I know that my ranch, even without the house and barn, is worth almost $1,000. I figure that, in the long run, you are making out on the deal.
C.D. Folsom took a long look at the returning veteran across his desk.
All right. I'll have Miss Stewart drop the papers for you to sign.
Thank you.
Where are you going now?
Martin smiled.
Out west.
As Matt Kavanaugh and his family prepared to start their trek west, another young man, some 8 years older than Matt, stood in front of a trading post watching his own father ride away. When he and his father came out west a year earlier, they met up with an old mountain man known only as Preacher. Preacher befriended the men, taking a special interest in young Kirby Jensen, providing him with an education in survival that was the equal in intensity and thoroughness to a doctorate in any chartered university. Kirby had already proven his worth in a short but savage Indian battle, and though he was only 17 years old, he could hold his own with anyone. Preacher gave him the nickname Smoke, and already Smoke thought of himself in that way.
Where's Pa going, Preacher?
Preacher squirted out a stream of tobacco juice, then swiped the back of his hand across his mouth before he answered.
Your Pa ever tell you about a man by the name of Casey? Ted Casey?
I've heard the name, and from the way he said it, I figured there was bad blood between them, but he never told me anything specific.
I reckon that's because he still sees you as a boy, not a man. Maybe your Pa always looks at his son that way.
Pa's going to look Casey up?
Preacher nodded.
Yeah, he's got some business to take care of with him.
Killing business?
Preacher nodded.
Yeah, I reckon so. Problem is, Casey ain't likely to be alone.
Smoke watched as his father stopped, turned his horse around, and waved. Smoke returned the wave, and his paw was gone, dipping out of sight over the rise of a small hill. Smoke's paw took a few gold coins with him, but he left the bulk of his money with his son. Smoke felt the weight of the money in his pouch.
He won't be coming back, will he, Preacher?
Like as not, he won't. You want to cry, Smoke? Why, there ain't no shame in it. You could just step around behind the trading post and have yourself a good cry all alone.
I haven't cried since my Ma died. I don't reckon I'll be doing any crying now.
Smoke made a few purchases with the money his father left him, and now with a new pistol, knife, and Henry rifle in his saddle sheath, he rode with Preacher through the thick timber and up into the high country. It was their way to ride without talking, so Smoke saved all his questions for night time, when they were camped by a small fire as it cooked the bacon and warmed the coffee.
How old were you when you come out here, Preacher?
14 or so. I ran away from home at 12, fought in the Battle of New Orleans, worked up river in St. Louis, and found my way out here. Been here ever since.
You never been back east?
I once. I went to Philadelphia to kill a man that needed killing, but for the most part, I've been out here all along.
You never got married?
Injun married.
Got any kids?
You ask a lot of damn questions.
Well, how am I going to learn if I don't ask questions?
You'll learn what I want you to learn. Now, you get some sleep now. We got us a lot of riding to do yet.
I wonder if this was what it's like to be at sea.
For the last 2 weeks, Matt, his parents, and sister had been following a set of wagon tracks that stretched front and back from horizon to horizon, broken here and there by deeply cut gullies and rock outcroppings. The wagon tracks were from the days of the great wagon trains 2 decades earlier. Now their wagon was all alone, its movement providing the only animation on the vast open plain. Matt and his father walked alongside the wagon while Matt's mother, Mary, drove. Cassie had been walking as well, but a few minutes earlier climbed up onto the seat to ride beside Mary.
Pa, what was it like in the war?
It was like Satan opened the gates of hell and we marched in.
Really? You mean like it says in the Bible? With the devil in a burning pit of fire?
You might say that. There was fire, and there certainly was a devil. And just who he was depends on the telling, I reckon.
Martin, over there.
Martin moved up to the front of the wagon so he could look to the other side in the direction pointed out by Mary. He saw six riders coming toward him.
Indians, do you think?
No, I don't think so. Not from the way they're riding.
The riders, still about a half a mile away, turned toward the wagon, approaching it at a leisurely gait.
What do you think they want?
I don't know.
Should I stop?
I see no need to stop. Just keep on going. I reckon we'll find out what they want when they get here.
The wagon continued to roll across the plains. All the while, Martin kept an eye on the riders as they came closer and closer.
Matt, move the rifle over to where I can get to it.
Martin, no. You are just one man. You know you can't take them all on. And if they see you with a rifle, it might provoke them.
Martin ran his hand over his cheek, then nodded.
You may be right.
The riders, all of whom were wearing long tan dusters, came up to the wagon. Martin recognized two of them. One was the man with the puffy scar that disfigured his left eye. One of the others was the man with half an ear.
Payson, isn't it? Sergeant Payson?
You got a good memory, Captain Cavanaugh.
Payson stretched his mouth into what might have been a smile.
What are you boys doing out here?
Oh, just sort of riding around, looking at the countryside.
Payson nodded toward the wagon.
Moving, are you?
Yeah, wasn't much left for me when I got home, I'm afraid.
So, you're starting over, are you?
You might say that.
You got any money?
Beg your pardon?
Money? You don't really think you're gonna be able to get a fresh start if you don't have no money, do you?
Martin didn't like the way the conversation was going.
We don't have any money. I spent everything I had on the wagon and things we'd need to make a new start.
Payson turned to the others.
What do you think about this? Here's a man who was smart enough to be a captain in the Yankee Army, but is so dumb that he comes out here with no money.
Well, hell, Payson, how smart do you have to be a captain in the Yankee Army?
You were one of them, and so were you.
She pointed to the bushy-bearded Laird Garvey.
He was one of who?
You were one of the ones who burned our house and barn.
Could be. Garvey and me rode with Bloody Bill Anderson. We burned us up a lot of Yankee houses and barns. But that was war. Well, you see that, don't you, Captain?
Yes. The war's over now, and I figure a lot of us have done things we'd just as soon not remember.
And you don't have any money, huh?
No, I don't. And I'd feel a lot better if you folks would just ride on and leave us be.
But what if we don't want to ride on?
Then I'd be obliged to make you move on.
How you gonna do that? There's only one of you, and there's six of us.
You seem to be the one in charge. I'll kill you.
Payson threw his duster to one side and raised a double-barrel shotgun. Martin snicked his pistol from his holster in a lightning-fast draw. Payson smiled. The shotgun blast at nearly point-blank range opened up Martin's chest, cutting his heart to shreds. He was dead before he hit the ground.
Get the two women down here. If they ain't got no money, we may as well have us some fun.
Matt, run!
Matt grabbed a rifle and darted into the rocks alongside the wagon trail.
What about the boy?
You can have him if that's your taste. For me, I'm gonna have me one of these women.
The others laughed at Payson's comment. Then they grabbed Mary and Cassie and jerked them down from the wagon seat. Mother and daughter fought hard, biting and scratching.
Damn you! Be still!
Mary and Cassie continued to struggle, putting up such a fight that Payson and Laird, who took first dibs, couldn't get the job done.
Oh, to hell with that!
Payson took a knife from his belt and slashed it across Mary's throat.
Cut the bitch, Garvey!
Oh, shit!
Payson stood up and looked down at the bodies of Mary and Cassie.
Why the hell they make us do that?
Hell, I don't want them now.
I'll do it.
What are you talking about, Cooper? They're both dead.
What the hell difference does that make? Hell, all I wanted was a poke. Wasn't aiming to make her fall in love with me. Anyone else gonna join in the fun?
By the time Matt found a place in the rocks that would let him see what was going on, his mother and sister were dead. Matt was less than 25 yards away from the six men who were standing around his mother and sister. He aimed the rifle at Cooper's head and pulled the trigger. A sudden gunshot startled everyone.
What the hell?
Payson spun around. Behind him, Cooper pitched back with blood and brain matter oozing from the top of his head. The moment Matt shot, he pulled back from the rock where he'd been and slipped into a very narrow fissure between two large rocks. As a result, Payson didn't see Matt, but he did see a wisp of gun smoke hanging in the air from where Matt had fired.
It's the damn kid! He's got hold of a rifle!
Get him!
He ran in between them rocks!
Lucas, you the smallest one of us. See if you can get in there and pull him out.
Nodding, Lucas ran to the two rocks, then started squeezing through the narrow opening between them.
Can you get through?
Yeah! Yeah, it's tight, but I can do it.
Lucas struggled to work through. From his position behind another rock about 10 yards beyond the fissure, Matt watched Lucas working hard to squeeze through. He was in a very contorted position when Matt noticed that, while both arms were through, his waist, and consequently his gun, was not. Matt stood up then and stared pointedly at Lucas.
Ha! Payson! Garvey, come on! We got his ass now!
No.
Matt lifted the rifle to his shoulder.
I've got yours.
What? No! Kick!
The rifle kicked back against Matt's shoulder as a black hole appeared in Lucas's forehead. Matt had now killed two men in as many minutes.
What are we gonna do, Payson? Just stay around here until that little brat shoots us all, one at a time?
Corey, Taggart, you find anything in that wagon?
No money, Payson. Just some bacon, beans, coffee, flour, and sugar.
Now take the bacon and coffee and let's get out of here. And take the horses, Corey.
What about the brat?
Leave him. He's out here in the middle of nowhere all by himself. If Injuns or wolves don't get him, he'll likely starve to death or...
Payson took an axe from the side of the wagon and smashed the water barrel. The water that Matt and his family so preciously hoarded spilled to the ground in one quick splash.
Die of thirst.
What about Lucas and Cooper?
They're dead.
Well, I know they're dead. What are we gonna do about them?
Leave them.
We can't just leave them here.
Why not? Ain't gonna bother them none. Come on, let's go.
What about the wagon?
Burn it.
Matt could no longer hear him. He wasn't sure if they actually left or if they just pretended to leave, so he stayed where he was, listening to the sound of burning wood, smelling it, and watching the smoke roil into the sky. Matt spent the rest of the day tucked in the rocks, then the whole night, then most of the next day. Finally, he decided to take a look. Matt came out from the crevice, then climbed up on one of the rocks and looked down at the scene. There was nothing left of the wagon except blackened residue. The iron bands around what once were the wheels and the chain of the tree. 5 bodies, his mother, father, and sister, as well as the 2 he killed, finished the scene. 4 lay on the ground, 1 hung still wedged in the crevice between the rocks. Matt started to climb down when he saw another wagon approaching. This wasn't the kind of wagon he and his family traveled in. This wagon was somewhat smaller and squared off with wooden sides. It was making a terrible racket as it rolled across the plains, and as it got closer, he could read the big red sign on the side. Mo Goodman, pots, pans, knives, and notions. Matt slipped behind the rock and waited until the wagon approached. He watched the wagon stop and the driver stare in shock at the carnage.
Oh my, what has happened here?
The driver set the brake, then climbed down from the wagon and walked over to look at the bodies. He examined Matt's father, then his mother and sister for a long time. Then he walked over to look at Cooper, then took a cursory glance toward Lucas, who was still wedged in the crevice. Shaking his head sadly, the driver walked back to his wagon and untied a shovel that hung on the side. He started digging. Matt watched for several more minutes, then deciding that anyone who would take the time to dig a grave for someone he didn't even know must be a good man. Matt climbed down from the rock. He walked up behind the man who, because of his digging, didn't notice Matt's approach.
That's my ma and pa. And my sister. Sorry. Didn't mean to scare you.
Well, you did, boy. You like to give me a fit.
The man's expression softened.
Your ma, pa, and sister, huh?
Yes, sir.
And who might these two be?
They're the ones I killed.
You killed?
Yes, sir. I killed them.
How old are you, boy?
I'm 9.
What's your name?
Matt Cavanaugh.
I'm Mo Goodman.
Thanks for burying my folks.
Well, seems like the only decent thing to do.
You've got another shovel. I'll help dig.
So happens I do.
Mo walked back over to his wagon. He opened the back door, reached inside, and pulled one out.
Brand new. I reckon using it one time will keep me from selling it.
Matt took the shovel, and for the next several minutes, the only sound was the sound of the spades turning dirt.
Well, I'll say this for you, Matt.
What's that?
You got yourself one hell of a start in life. Yeah.
Smoke and his mentor Preacher ran across another old mountain man named Grizzly. They shared a meal of venison, potatoes mixed with wild onions and gravies sopped up by a piece of pan bread Smoke made for him. The three ate in relative silence. Then Grizzly nodded toward Smoke but addressed his remark to Preacher.
It's all right to talk in front of the boy. Well, don't ask me. He's a man full grown to ask him.
Boy, Smoke. This here's gonna concern you, and I reckon it ain't gonna be pleasant.
Smoke steeled himself for the worst.
I'm listening.
A man rode in here about 2 months ago. He's all shot up bad. Strange man he was. Dug his own grave before he died. It was like as if he just hung on long enough not to put anyone else out.
He give you a name?
Yeah. Said his name was Emmett. Emmett Jensen.
Smoke nodded.
That'd be my pa.
Well, yeah. I reckoned it would be. He told me he had a boy who'd been traveling with Preacher, and when I seen the two of you, well, I knowed who it was without asking.
Where's he buried? Me and Smoke here might like to visit the grave and pay our respects.
Well, like I say, he chose his own spot. He's on a little plain at the base of the high peak east of the canyon. You know where that is?
Yeah, I know where it is.
Grizzly reached into a little bag and pulled out a heavy sack. He tossed the sack over to Smoke.
This here belongs to you. Right smart amount of gold in there.
You could have taken it. You could have taken it and I wouldn't have never known you anything about it.
Well, I reckon I could have, but I would have known. He left you a letter too. I figured you might want it.
Grizzly handed Smoke another package. This one, flat and wrapped in rawhide to protect it from the elements.
Thanks.
Grizzly got up from the fire, wiped off the seat of his pants, and walked over to his pony. He mounted up, took the lead to his pack horses, and rode off without looking back. When Preacher and Smoke rose the next morning, Smoke started saddling his horse. Preacher watched Smoke for a few minutes. Then he filled his pipe and lit it from a small burning twig he took from the campfire.
Looks like you're leaving.
Seems right.
I wish you all the best.
Smoke looked down from his saddle at the old man who had been such an important part of his life for nearly 2 years now.
Preacher, you taught me how to find my way around, how to shoot, what plants I can eat, and what I should stay away from. Fact is, I reckon I wouldn't be alive if it weren't for you.
Well, you's easy to teach.
Preacher pointed to the pistol at Smoke's side.
But one thing I didn't teach, because you just got a God-given natural talent for it, and that's pulling your gun.
Unconsciously, Smoke put his hand on the handle of his Colt 44.
I ain't never seen no one who could pull a gun as fast as you, Smoke, or shoot it as well. It's gonna come in real handy for you, but it's also gonna be a burden.
A burden?
And you're damn right, boy, a burden. There'll be those who'll hear about you and they'll want to test you. That's where the danger's gonna lie, because you won't be expecting it. It won't be anybody you've ever run into before. Like as not, you won't even have words with them. They'll know who you are, but you won't know who they are.
Well, I thought about that. I know what you mean.
Preacher nodded.
I figured you smart enough to understand it, but I wanted to warn you about it anyway.
Smoke leaned over and patted his horse on the neck.
Preacher, I think the time has come for me to be going off on my own now.
You'll be looking for Casey, will you?
I reckon so.
What's got to be done has got to be done. You don't be a stranger now, you hear? drop in and see an old man from time to time.
I'll do that.
Smoke slapped his legs against the side of his horse. Two days later, Smoke found his pa's grave. Dismounting, he looked around until he located a rock that was just right. Then, using a small hammer and a miner's spike, he chiseled his father's name and the year of his birth, 1815, as well as the year of his death, 1866, and put the rock at the head of the grave. He would have liked to put some sort of message on the headstone, but it was hard enough just to get the name and dates on. That done, Smoke hung a small coffee pot over the campfire, then found a comfortable place to sit and read the letter his father had left him.
Son, I found the man who killed your brother Luke and stole the gold that belonged to the Gray. But he had more with him than I thought he would. I killed two of them, but they got lead in me, and I had to hightail it out. I come here to this place, but I'm not going to make it. Son, you don't have no call to try and settle accounts for me and your brother, so don't get in your mind to do. Make yourself a good life. I'm getting tired, and seeing is hard. Light fading. Love you, Kirby. Smoke. Pa.
His name was Landers. Brother Charles G. Landers, a simple man of God, was the way he introduced himself to Mo Goodman. Goodman explained how his life as a peddler wouldn't allow him to keep the boy, and he asked Landers if he could find a home for Matt.
Indeed I can. There are many among my scattered flock who would take great joy in receiving into their bosom a wonderful young man like this.
From the moment he laid eyes on Landers, there was something about him that didn't set well with Matt. He wanted to ask Mo not to give him to the itinerant preacher, wanted to beg to be allowed to stay, but, well, he said nothing. Landers was unlike any preacher Matt ever saw. Over the 4 days they traveled the trail, Landers cursed, got drunk, and once paid an Indian woman to be with her. Matt didn't know what family Landers was going to leave him with, but anything had to be an improvement over the current situation. On the 5th day, they came into a settlement identified by a sign just outside the town as Soda Creek. Soda Creek boasted one main street, fronted on both sides by rip-sawed, weather-beaten, false-fronted buildings. From what Matt could tell from his position on the horse behind Landers, it consisted mostly of saloons. One building that didn't have a sign to identify it sported several women sitting out on an upstairs porch. As Landers rode by, a couple of the women stepped up to the railing and looked down. Matt glanced toward them, then cut his eyes away in quick embarrassment. It looked almost as if the women had come outside in their underwear. The two who leaned over the rail were showing the tops of their breasts.
Hey, preacher man, where'd you come by that little boy?
Landers stared straight ahead.
Why aren't you leaving with us? It'd be nice to have a young boy around.
Yes, we'll raise him right. Why, by the time he gets old enough, he'll know how to treat a woman real good.
Matt wasn't sure what was so funny.
Brother Landers, who are those women?
Boy, don't you pay them. No, never mind. They're nothing but harlots, the lot of them.
What's a harlot?
It's a woman that a man pays to be with.
Like the Indian woman you were with the other night?
Oh, shut up about that, boy. Don't you say nothing about that to nobody. What I was doing was saving that poor heathen's eternal soul. Most folks wouldn't understand that, because most folks got dirty minds.
Yes, sir. Where's the family that's going to take me?
There ain't no family going to take you.
But you said...
I know what I said, but it don't work like that. First thing I got to do is... get you into an orphanage. They can't nobody take you unless the law says it's right. And the law's got to go through the orphanage.
Oh.
Matt had not considered an orphanage. Though as he was now an orphan, he supposed that it made sense.
Where's the orphanage?
Boy, you ask too many questions. Things will go a lot better if you just keep your mouth shut and do as you're told.
Yes, sir.
Daniel L. Mumford had been elected as captain of the 1st Idaho Cavalry during the Civil War. The 1st Idaho was never activated, but Mumford continued to call himself Captain Mumford and insisted that all who dealt with him refer to him in that way. Captain Mumford was director of the Soda Creek Home for Wayward Boys and Girls. There had been some who suggested that the term wayward implied that the children were behavioral problems, when most were merely orphans. However, as Mumford pointed out, several of his residents were children of prostitutes who died either of disease or of alcoholism or even given birth.
And those children, being issue of wayward women, are by inheritance wayward.
When Landers came to see him, Mumford was going over his books. He had three ways of supporting the home. One was a grant from the territorial government in Boise. A second was from generous donations made by the three churches in town. And the third, and most lucrative, was from wages earned by the children Captain Mumford farmed out to the various businesses and individuals in and around the town of Soda Creek.
Captain Mumford, I wonder if I may have a word with you, sir.
Mumford shook his head.
We have been through all this before, Landers. I am not going to allow you to conduct a church service in the home. Why, it would be so disruptive that we would wind up losing at least half a day's earnings, maybe more.
Landers held up his hand and shook his own head.
No, it's nothing like that. I understand your position and would never try and compromise it.
Well, I'm glad you see it that way, Landers. Now, what can I do for you?
It's more of, in the order of what I can do for you.
Mumford's face brightened.
You have a donation for the home? How marvelous of you.
Oh, no, nothing like that.
No.
What I do have for you is another guest.
Another mouth to feed? No, impossible. We are overcrowded as it is.
But this is a fine, a strong young boy. I'm sure that you will be able to find a position for him somewhere that will prove to be quite lucrative for you.
Mumford stroked his chin.
You say he's a strong boy?
Oh, yes.
Well, how old is he?
I think he's about 12.
Landers lied. He knew Matt was not yet 10.
Well, perhaps I could find a place for him. A young man like that can always bring in enough money to support himself.
Good. I thought you might see it that way. You can have him for $25.
What? Are you out of your mind?
Not a bit of it. If you aren't interested in buying the boy, I can always sell him to some farmer or rancher who lives nearby.
You aren't going to find anyone who will give you $25 for him.
Then I'll sell him for what I can get.
I'll give you $5.
$20.
They eventually settled on $12.50, and after Landers counted and pocketed the money, he went back outside where Matt was leaning against the hitching post, watching the activity of the town.
I've got it all set up for you. It's costing me $12.50, but I'll have the personal satisfaction of knowing you will be safe.
Thank you, Brother Landers.
Oh, I'm only doing my Christian duty, boy. You learn from that, so you can grow up to be a decent, God-fearing man.
Yes, sir.
Landers swung back into the saddle.
All right, you go on in now.
Matt reached for his rifle, but Landers put his hand out to stop him.
Oh, you won't be needing a gun in a place like this.
But it was my pa's rifle.
Let's just say it's you paying me back for the $12.50 I just spent on you.
But...
You gonna argue with me, boy? Supposing I give you your rifle back, what good will that do you? They'll take it away from you as soon as you go inside. And, like as not, it'll wind up getting sold, and you won't get one penny for it. Leastwise, this way, you know it's going to someone that was out some considerable money to get you situated.
Yes, sir. I guess you're right. All right, you can keep my pa's rifle.
Oh, I'm glad you come to your senses. Go on in. The man you want to see is Captain Mumford.
Matt's eyes brightened somewhat.
My pa was a captain. Maybe Captain Mumford knew him.
Yeah, maybe.
Landers slapped his legs against the side of his horse and rode away. Matt looked at the front door of the home. He remembered back home on the farm in Kansas how he would sometimes go swimming in the swimming hole. In the late spring, the water would still be really cold, and he would have to take a deep breath and get up his courage before jumping in. For some strange reason, he felt like that now. Squaring his shoulders, he walked up the brick walk, then opened the door and went inside.
Boy, have you no manners?
Sir?
You don't walk into someone's home without knocking on the door.
The man was thin and bald except for the side of his head, and that hair came down in bushy sideburns, though they did not join to make a beard.
I thought this was the orphanage. Maybe I'm in the wrong place. I'm sorry.
Matt turned and started to leave.
Did you come with Landers?
Yes, sir.
Then I already paid for you. You are in the right place.
You paid for me?
12.5 good dollars. You'll be working that off.
But he took my rifle.
Who took your rifle?
Brother Landers. He said he paid you so I could stay here, and he took my rifle to pay him back.
Let that be a lesson to you. Don't trust somebody just because they tell you they're a preacher.
Isn't he a preacher?
Well, he is sometimes, I reckon. What's your name?
Matthew Cav...
Mumford held up his hand.
Your ma and pa alive?
No, sir.
Then you don't have a last name.
But my last name is...
You don't have a last name. Do you understand that?
Yes, sir.
Yes, Captain Mumford.
What?
When you talk to me, you will always address me as Captain Mumford.
Yes, Captain Mumford.
You're awfully small for 12 years old.
I'm not 12.
Mumford slapped Matt in the face, not hard enough to knock him down or even bring blood, but hard enough that it stung.
What did you say?
I said, I'm not 12.
Mumford slapped him again.
You don't learn very well. Now, I'm going to ask you again. What did you say?
I said, I'm not 12, Captain Mumford.
Well, maybe you aren't so dumb after all. Not 12, huh? Well, how old are you?
I'm 9, Captain Mumford.
9, huh? Well, you are a big enough boy for 9. I'm sure I can find something for you to do. Connors!
An older boy came into the office from the back of the house.
Yes, Captain Mumford?
Here is a new boy. His name is Matthew. Take him into the back and...
Mumford paused for a moment, then smiled. Though Matt found the smile frightening rather than comforting.
Break him in.
Yes, Captain Mumford.
Connors' smile shone as malevolent as that of Mumford. Connors led Matt through a door and down a hall. Matt saw a room with a lot of bunk beds and he started toward it.
Nah, that's for the girls. Boys is this way.
There are girls in this place?
Yeah, but don't get no ideas about any of them. All the girls belong to me and Simon.
What do you mean they belong to you and Simon?
Connors looked at Matt.
Never mind. You're too young to know.
The room was long and relatively narrow. The floor was made of wide, unfinished boards, and the walls were nothing more than studs and outside planking. There was only one window in the room. The beds that ran in rows down either side of the room were crowded so close together that there was barely enough room to get between them. Most of the beds looked to be very Spartan, small even for children, with blankets with holes and lumpy cotton mattresses. There were no sheets.
You'll sleep here.
Connors pointed to one of the beds. Stuffing was coming from the mattress and roaches were running across the filthy blanket.
Where do you put your clothes?
Got anything other than what you're wearing?
No.
Then don't worry about it.
Glancing toward the far end of the room under the window, Matt saw two beds that were set aside from the others. These beds were larger, had sheets, pillows, and blankets. There was also a rack and shelf on the wall beside each bed and a trunk between the beds. Several changes of clothes hung from the racks, and boxes were stacked on the shelves. The open window provided some relief from the sweltering heat outside, though none of that relief reached the rest of the room. There was a stove there, too, and though the stove was not cold, it didn't take much thought for Matt to realize that what little warmth it would produce in the wintertime would be confined to the area immediately around it.
Who sleeps there?
Matt pointed to the two beds.
The bed on the left is mine, and don't ever let me see you down there. The other bed belongs to my friend Simon.
How come you two get the good beds?
You'll find out soon enough. The others is coming back for supper. To show you what a good guy I am, I'm gonna let you eat with us tonight, even though you ain't done no work yet to earn it.
You are gonna let me eat? I thought Captain Mumford was in charge.
He is in charge, but you'll mostly be dealing with me and Simon.
Connors smiled proudly and hooked his thumbs under his armpits.
Captain Mumford says that me and Simon is his sergeants.
Am I supposed to call you sergeant?
You don't even talk to me, boy, unless I talk to you first. I'm just talking to you now because you're new and you need to know the rules. Come on, I'll show you where we eat.
The dining room was about the same size as the dormitory. It had two long tables flanked on either side of the table by a wooden bench. One of the tables appeared to be for the girls, the other for boys. At the back of the room, there was one smaller table. Matt didn't have to ask who that table belonged to.
From here on, you are on your own.
Connors walked away. Matt saw a line of boys and girls, and figuring they were waiting to be fed, he joined them. At 9 years old, he decided he was one of the youngest, if not the youngest, but he wasn't the smallest. Matt had been around other children before, at school and in church, but he had never seen such dispirited expressions as he saw here. Not one person smiled. He heard no conversation, and in fact, there was very little interaction of any kind. They just stood there in silence, until a couple of women came out carrying a large pot and a plate of bread. The woman carrying the pot was very fat. The one carrying the tray of bread was very skinny.
Bow your heads!
Matt bowed his head, but he looked up with his eyes to see what the others were doing.
Lord, for the blessing of this food, we thank you.
The boy just in front of Matt turned to him.
You just get here today?
Yes.
My name's Eddie. What's yours?
Matt Kavanaugh.
Shh! Don't let nobody hear you say that.
Say what?
Your last name. We don't have last names in here. Don't none of us have last names.
That's right. Captain Mumford told me that.
It could get you a beating.
I wonder what's for supper.
Can sure tell you're new.
Why is that?
Because what it is for supper is what we have for supper every night. Peas, porridge, and bread. There's supposed to be some bacon in the peas porridge, but ain't nobody ever seen none.
You have that every night?
Oatmeal for breakfast every morning, peas porridge for supper every night.
And what about them?
Matt pointed to the table at the back of the room. There he saw Connors and another boy as big as he was. They were eating fried chicken and mashed potatoes, talking and laughing with each other.
That's Connors and Simon. They don't camp. They're Captain Mumford's toadies.
Toadies?
Yep. They get the best food, the best clothes, the best everything. Wait until you see where they sleep.
I did see it. Why do they get such good treatment?
The boy that was standing just in front of Eddie laughed.
For one thing, they're the oldest. They're both 13. And for another, they're tattletales. They tell Captain Mumford everything we do.
Oh.
I'm Timmy.
Matt. I'll bet they don't have any friends.
They don't need friends. They got everything else.
Matt took his bowl of peas porridge and a hunk of bread to the table where he sat with Eddie and Timmy. Eddie introduced him to some of the others, though for the moment the name sort of passed him by. He knew that if he stayed here long enough, he would eventually learn everyone's name, so he didn't ask anyone to repeat it. Matt looked down at his peas porridge with obvious distaste.
This is what we have for supper every night?
Every night.
What do we have for dinner?
We don't eat dinner here, but most of us get lunch from the place where we're working, and that's generally the best. Where will you be working?
I don't know.
You ever worked anywhere before?
I've mucked stable stalls.
Yeah, well, you don't want to have to do that if you can help it. Best thing to do is get a job with a cafe or a saloon. You'd be sweeping out and washing dishes, but you get to eat good there.
How do I get a job there?
I'll talk to Mr. McDougal down at the saloon and see if he'll ask for you.
The bread was good, and Matt was hungry, not having eaten since the day before when Lander shared some jerky with him. But not even hunger could make him eat the peas porridge. He took one bite and pushed the uneaten gruel away.
If you aren't going to eat that, can I have it?
How can you eat it?
After you've been here a while, it'll taste just like apple pie to you.
When have you ever had apple pie?
Well, I know it's good because I've heard said it was good.
Matt thought of the last apple pie his mother made. She used dried apples and made the pie on the trail for him just about 2 days before Payson and the others attacked. Matt's eyes filled and tears began streaming down his cheeks, but he didn't sob out loud. Timmy looked at Matt.
You thinking about apple pie your mama made?
Matt nodded, but he didn't speak.
I'm sorry I brung up the memory. Me, I ain't got no memories like that. They say my mama was a whore, but I got no way of knowing that. I don't even remember her.
Matt slid his bowl of porridge across.
No.
Timmy pushed it back.
Even if you don't like it, you better eat it.
Like you say, there'll come a time when I can eat it. But I can't eat it now. So you may as well take it.
Thanks, Matt. So, now you got two friends in here. Me and Eddie. That's good. Boys that come in here and don't make friends, they're the ones who have it the hardest.
Matt looked back at Connors and Simon, salivating as he saw them eating the fried chicken with such relish. The name of the little town was Prosperity, and it sat on the banks of the Cachara River. Prosperity was a ranching and farming community with a sign posted just outside the town limits with the proud boast, "Come watch us grow, progress and prosperity in Colorado." The city marshal, having seen smoke approaching from some distance away, met him just outside of town.
"Welcome to Prosperity, stranger. The name is Crow, Marshal Crow."
He put his hand to his badge, even though Smoke had already seen it.
"Marshal?"
Smoke touched the brim of his hat.
I didn't catch your name."
"Folks call me Smoke."
"Smoke?" "That's it? Smoke? Smoke what?"
"I've been spending some time in the mountains. My name is all anybody needs up there."
"Well, Smoke, if you're just making a friendly visit to my town, then you're welcome. But if you're coming here for any other reason, well, I'm gonna have to ask you to just keep riding."
"Looking for a man named Casey. Ted Casey."
"What do you want with him?"
"That's my business."
"I'm the law hereabouts. I reckon that makes it my business."
"Is that a fact?"
"You know what, mister? I don't much like your attitude. Why don't I just..."
That was as far as Crowell got. He was reaching for his gun, but stopped in mid-draw and mid-sentence when he saw the pistol in Smoke's hand.
"What the hell? I didn't even see you draw."
"Like I said, where is Casey?"
Smoke's calm tone made his question all the more frightening. Crowell hesitated for a few seconds.
"His ranch is southeast of here, on the flats. You'll cross a little creek before you see the house. I'd warn you, though, he's got several men working for him, and they're all good with a gun. Maybe not as fast as you, but there's only one of you."
"Got an undertaker in town?"
"Of course we do. Why would you ask?"
"I'm about to give him some business."
Ten miles out of town, Smoke encountered two rough-looking riders.
"You're on private land. Turn your horse around and get."
"You're not being very hospitable."
"Don't intend to be. Strangers ain't welcome here."
"I'm looking for Ted Casey."
"You deep for something I told you to get."
"I'm looking for Ted Casey."
"What do you want with Casey?"
"Just to renew an old friendship from the war."
"From the war? Boy, you're still wet behind the ears. You ain't old enough to have been in the war."
"I'm sorry I wasn't very clear. I'm actually looking him up for my pa."
"What was your pa's name?"
"Jensen. Emmett Jensen."
"Jensen?"
"Yeah. You remember him, don't you?"
"Kill him!"
Both riders grabbed for their pistols. They were too slow. Smoke had his pistol in his hand. The two riders dropped from their saddles, one dead, the other dying. The dying rider pulled himself up on one elbow. Blood poured through his chest wound, pink and frothy, indicating that the ball passed through a lung.
"Figured when we killed your pa, that would be the end of it." "Good. A hell of a lot better than your brother. Casey shot him low in the back. Took him a long time to die, too. I enjoyed watching him. He was a coward. Squealed like a pig and cried like a little girl."
Smoke made no reply.
"So was your pa, coward."
Smoke remained quiet.
"What's the matter with you? You just gonna let me talk about your folks like that? You're yellow."
Smoke turned his horse and rode around the two men, following the road in the same direction from which the two riders had come.
"Shoot me, you yellow-bellied coward! Don't leave me here to die like this! Shoot me!"
Smoke continued to ride away. Smoke didn't bother to look around at the sound of the rider swallowing his own bullet.